When something isn't volatile, question the crap out of it, is what I say. There was a good friend of mine who was a strong investor, very little volatility, like clockwork. His name's Bernie, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Is he in jail for 150 years?
This podcast contains the arguably witty banter of two friends, Skippy and Doodles, that like to debate about investing. The content is intended to be entertaining and for informational purposes only, not investment advice. You should do your own research and consult a financial professional before using any of the information in this podcast, and especially before investing.
Hey, hey.
What's up, Doodles?
Earthing. Earthing's up. What kind of a generic question is this? Like, what is up? What is going on? Everything is going on. Where do you want to start? Where do you want to start, man?
I want to start with Nike. So hold on. I sent you this week. Did you know Nike's on a 50% drawdown right now? Their stock.
I did not before you sent that over to me.
Okay. And that's a stock I've always wanted to pick up, more like nostalgia than anything else. Like,
yeah,
just quality brand, right? I mean, I looked at it. I still feel like it's too expensive for me.
Yeah. So it's not a cheap stock.
Yeah, I'm going to need this thing to go down like another 50% from here before I can even get interested. I think Nike is one I just don't get to own in my life.
What I do love is when people take news like that and then just make ridiculous statements. There was in the tweet thread that you sent, there's someone that went, yeah, who even buys Nike anymore? Like, running shoes are dead. And I went, where did that come from? Like, Nike is still, you know, we just a couple months ago, Nike's one of the strongest brands in the world.
It's the biggest athletic apparel company in the world.
Yeah.
By a long shot.
This is just a stock chart, man. This is just a stock chart. Calm down.
That guy needs to come on the show so I can yell at him. Nike spends more on R&D in athletics than all the other places combined. Like, very impressive company. We don't need to be throwing shit like that. But here's what Nike did. Nike has upset some of our friends.
Uh-oh.
Some of our German friends are pretty upset because starting in 2027, Nike will be the official merchandise provider of the German men's and women's soccer teams. I had to read the headline several times. I still cannot believe it.
Well, it's because there's no athletic company in Germany. They had to go to Nike, right?
Except for Adidas.
Yes, little Adidas.
And the evil brother that formed Puma. You know that story, right?
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah.
They are across the river from something and they hate each other.
Okay. Nobody besides those two.
So the German Football Association said that Nike made by far the best financial offer. And they were impressed with the vision of developing women's football and amateur grassroots sports in Germany. But they did not say how much the deal is worth. I think this deal... Okay, so you run the German Football Association, Doodles.
True.
How much bigger does this deal... Does this have to be like three times bigger than what Adidas was willing to provide? What do you think?
I would think it would need to be something like that because of how aggressively Adidas would want this. Like Adidas, this is a slap in the face. So I would think as the runner of the association, I would want it and Adidas would want it. So I would assume that Nike's bid would have to be big. Was it not?
I mean, it was best, but they don't exactly say how much bigger. So the partnership between Adidas and German football is a piece of the German identity. Adidas was founded in 1949 and has effectively been the official merchandise provider of the German national teams ever since. This is shocking. I mean, I don't, there's not much to break down,
no.
But can you imagine? Well, actually, would there be backlash in America? A similar backlash? It probably wouldn't be.
No, I don't think that Nike represents American pride by any notion, but I would assume that in Germany, a company like Adidas, both Nike and soccer, neither of which are like American pride. Yeah. So I don't think it would be the same thing. It might be like if Adidas became the official sponsor of the University of Oregon, I think that
the alumni would be as upset as the current yeah. German nationals.
Yeah, like where does that come from? You know, that would be weird.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Shocking news. Maybe I'll pick up some threads. I'm pretty excited about, I think their jerseys are going to be sweet. So,
I mean, obviously.
Yeah. If the German teams in like 2028 are winning World Cups, like it's going to, they're going to have some sick threads.
Looking good, yeah. Feeling good, playing good. I like that. I like that a lot. Love it. I'm going to make a transition, complete transition. There's nothing I'm tying to that. Reach into the fishbowl to talk about blundering. This is an old Charlie Munger type adage of avoid doing the wrong thing and things go well over time. That's not his quote, but that's the general philosophy. This is a piece that covers amateur chess, covers amateur tennis playing, but then mostly is about startups. So what it's saying is that blundering is 80% of the problem. And what that means is that if you can make the list of the things not to do, it's a great way. What I'd say, it's a great way to get started. It's not saying that this is the way to become great, but it's a fantastic way to like get the flywheel going at the very least. And that's kind of the point with Charlie Munger and investing, is because investing is something that happens over a long period of time. So therefore, it's not like you're trying to say, I'm going to be the best investor for the next 3 years. Like that's a gambling situation, but over time, it's a great way to do it. All right. So what this piece starts off with is, as I mentioned, it starts off with chess. And this guy is an amateur chess player, self-described like mediocre at best amateur chess player. And he analyzed his chess playing on chess.com, which apparently, I don't know about chess.com, but apparently it looks at every game and looks at like the number of moves that you had. It looks at how many mistakes you made, all that kind of stuff. And he said, if he looks at all of his matches, he's basically played people of the same caliber, won about 50% of the games. But what he noticed was if you look at mistakes and what they call blunders, and you add those up, that 86% of the time, whoever made the most blunders or mistakes lost. Similar, this wasn't his research, but there's research around tennis. And in amateur tennis, it's about playing conservatively and just not making mistakes. Just keep the ball in play. And eventually, because you're both amateurs, someone's going to make a mistake. And it's whoever makes the least amount of mistakes loses. I love this as a general philosophy. I think when it comes to investing, those are not investing things. But when it comes to investing, I think it's so similar. And so I'm going to cover a couple other points as he goes into startup land that I think have analogies to investing. And feel free to interrupt me if something's interessant for you. So first, when he dives into the question of why do startups fail, he said there are all these reasons that are often given, but he calls them proximate causes. Because people will say, well, you ran out of cash. He goes, yes, obviously. That's like saying that I died because my heart stopped. Like, I want to know the actual reason. So the other proximate causes are there's a pivot gone bad. So there's like a strategy that was chosen and didn't work. The founder stopped. And I love what he wrote here. In parentheses, he goes, as opposed to what? Like if the startup failed, was the founder going to keep going? Like that's an impossibility. That's an obvious thing. Or you didn't find product market fit. And he's saying that's the equivalent of saying, and like, it's not helpful, basically. It's just like not a helpful description. And then he goes in this list. I think this is cool with investing too. He goes in this list of what aren't the reasons. And I think that's an interesting way to look at it. As if you can say, and so I'll say the ones he brought up around startups in general, but I think even in the investing world, you can go, what aren't the reasons why this particular investment or my strategy over the last couple of years like didn't work? What aren't the reasons? And then it can be helpful to figure out the reasons. So a few of the things he named, he said a bad idea is like one of the reasons why startups don't fail. You can't build it, the number of co-founders, and location. Now, what this doesn't mean is that it's impossible for those to be a reason, but they're so generalized, like number of co-founders, having a single founder, having three co-founders, both of those have companies that have worked. So while it might be harder in a certain, like with one founder, it doesn't mean that that's the reason why you didn't fail. So anything so far? Should I keep going?
For the tennis point, there's a book called The Inner Game of Tennis that relates to investing. That's really good. And would clearly articulate his point here.
Yep. All right. So the last thing, is he talks about preventable blunders. And this is the list to pay attention to. So what are the preventable blunders that you have? And preventable, I mean, it's straight up as the word prevent, right? It means you can see it ahead of time. You know that this is going to be extremely difficult or impossible to do, and you could just not participate. So yeah. I'm just going to name a few of them. He has a long list. One is in startup land that there's no market. He's like, you know, there was no market to begin with. Like you just knew that. So that's preventable. Second, not talking to customers. This is one I see a lot in the startup world where people, you'll sit and be like, I've got a great idea. And you start building a product. And just, it's so easy to talk to people. Like, so, like, it's simple to talk. Just go talk to people. I also get impressed in interviews when I interview somebody. And when they come and they're like, well, I actually went and spoke with X, Y, or Z people in the industry. And I'm like, how easy was that? And most people never end up doing it.
Well, and for those on the other side, maybe you're not in the startup world, something you might not know is you can hop on a CEO's startup founders calendar at almost any point if you use their product and they're good. Yeah. Like, I talk to these people all the time, especially when I use their product, because I go, there's real problems with XYZ, but you guys are like, you guys will not work for me unless you fix this. And yeah. They listen, and a lot of times I fix it too. So completely agree. So yeah. Important.
Because as a founder, the company is your baby. And so when someone says, I see a blemish, you go, hold on. Right. Yeah, so that's exactly right. It's exactly right. No target audience is another one. Too many things have to go right. No differentiation. There's a bunch that he names. Those are the ones I'm going to pull out. Now for investing, why I thought this was interesting is it's similar. Depending on your style and how you think about investing, I think there's some similarities here. Preventable blunders. If there's no market for the organization that you're looking at, then what you're betting on is public perception or some kind of wave that's going to take over. Like that's what you're betting on. And if that turns out not to be a blunder, it's luck.
If I was to invest in Truth Social,
as an example,
and the market was telling me that they could do about $3 million in revenue per year, it's not worth seven. I just said billion. I meant million.
Exactly.
Point taken.
Exactly.
Move on from my joke here. Yeah.
I'd say the not talking to customers to me is the equivalent of not reading about the organization. It's like not looking at the financials, not looking at the 10K. That's what I would say. It's like not doing baseline due diligence. If you look at too many things have to go right, I want to stick on this one for a moment. Because this is the case where you say, if you make a list, I love lists that are based off of what you have to believe in order for something to go true. I use it all the time, like at work. If what you have to believe are 19 different things that have to compound together, it's not any of these 19 could make it more valuable. It's all of these 19 have to go right. Then again, you're betting on luck.
I say, have you read The Model Thinker by Scott Page?
Ooh, it rings a bell.
His phrase for that is, what assumptions have to prove true for your model to be right? It's the exact thing that you're saying. And so if your bet on this company doubling involves the Fed keeping rates where they currently are and 20 other things, it's not a good bet. If it involves, you know, for me, it's often mean reversion, and that's about the only thing you need to go right, then it's easier.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of another version of this, not to go down this rabbit hole because I take us down here all the time, but when we discuss the state of the consumer and the economy, it's that there are so many things that if any of them tip over the scale, it could potentially be bad, but it's not all of the things. And those are the situations where you're like, ooh. So now if you're betting on the other side of that, none of those things can go wrong. Yeah. Right. Yep. All right. This is different than looking at the company, but the last one I want to talk about here is no differentiation. And this I'll take off if you go back to when Adam came on the pod and was talking about how his public stock market investing, he just sees as pure speculation and gambling. He puts like a tiny bit of money because it's fun. But private markets are where he believes he has an edge. If you as an investor do not understand or know what your differentiation or your edge potentially could be, it's probably a blunder. That's all that I'll say. It's probably a blunder. So I thought this was an interesting piece because of that reason. It has its analogies to investing. Also just analogies in life in general. Life is the ultimate game. And so if you can just avoid doing the wrong things, Charlie Munger did have a quote about life here. It was something like, tell me where I'm going to die and I just won't go there. It was something like that, which apparently no one said your bed. But anyway,
he died at the hospital.
Oh, he did? Oh, okay. And so he didn't go to bed.
His family drove him there. And yeah. And he greeted the nurse. Did you read this? He greeted the nurse. The nurse goes like, hi, how are you today? And he says, I'm dying. How are you today? In a very kind Munger way. He was resolved that it was the end based on
Charlie. Yeah. And speaking of books, there is a book called Winning the Loser's Game that is an investing book that goes off the same general adage. I'd say it's a fine book.
Mm-hmm.
So not a strong recommendation for me, but it looks at investing through this lens if this is of interest to you.
Best of luck out there winning the loser's game, folks. I came across an interview with Dan Scrum of No Name Stocks. Now, we're going to travel to microcap land, Diggles, which we'll see if our audience likes this or not. I'm always fascinated with this. And according to Dan's blog, No Name Stocks, he's up about 2,000% since 2013. Really impressive performance. But I think you guys are going to see very quickly why this is not the game for you and me. That does not mean it's
honestly,
not interesting.
Honestly, I don't know if this is the game for Dan. Let's keep going. Yeah.
It's cool though. It's a great interview. Like 11 pages long, really in depth. He even gives some stock picks at the end, which are fascinating, fundamental driven stuff. It's just when you get into microcap land, some of these companies have like $2 million in annual revenue and they're so-called publicly traded, but there's no market there. Like, do not place a limit order for any of these microcap stuff because they're tiny, tiny companies.
Yeah. No liquidity.
No liquidity at all. What I found most interesting in the whole interview, and the only thing I really want to dive into, is he talked about like where he fishes and what he finds intriguing. And so he'll typically focus on stocks that are under $2 a share, near all-time lows, with less than 20 million shares outstanding, that are cheap by traditional metrics, and that aren't widely followed even by other micro-cap investors. So for those who don't know, basically there's no analysts at Bank of America or anywhere else covering the microcap land in the first place. And then there are a few analysts that specialize in microcap stuff. He's trying to find stuff that's not even covered by those analysts. His reason why makes total sense and in a way rings true with Munger and others is like he's going to the place where he thinks there's basically no one else looking at the stock. And he thinks he can exploit the fact that literally all the eyeballs are somewhere else. He hopefully finds a deal, builds a position slowly, and then lets the fundamentals take over. And if, say, and this is just a made-up example, but say the company does compound at 30% a year with their earnings for the next 10 years, he could potentially ride that wave and sit on it. And then some eyeballs eventually make their way there, and that's when he's able to flip it.
One correction I'll make, because you said fundamentals.
Yeah.
The way my interpretation of this was it's like targeted gambling, because he's saying that it could either be like, well, maybe actually I'll rewind. What he said was any change, like these companies are so small and their prices are so low that any change to the positive can be helpful. And he also has losers, as we all do.
Yeah.
So it could just be that the public decides to notice that the stock exists, or it could be that a market, nothing to do with the company itself, a market starts to take off and for some reason it increases. So it's not just the fundamentals. I just wanted to
let's chat about that, because I think that's interesting. I think in his mind, he's thinking about probabilistic outcomes, And the reason I say it's fundamental driven is because on page 8 or 9 of this interview, when he talks about some of his stock picks, so one that he talks about is a OTC company with the ticker PCYN, with the current market cap of 1.6 million. If the listeners didn't believe how crazy and how small these stocks are, there we go. He says the reason he likes it is because it has a $2.4 million book value and almost $5 million in annual revenue. And the example he gives for why he's intrigued by this is basically this is a family-owned company that almost never, they're like a break-even company. But yep. In previous years, if their margins have exploded to like 10 or 15%, people do take notice. And the stock goes from its current level of 20 cents to a dollar. And he thinks that's an opportunity. So yeah. it might be gambling, but it's gambling where he feels like the odds are in his favor, right?
Yeah, that's what I meant by targeted. So you're right. It's not okay. It's not just throwing things out randomly. Like it's highly informed gambling is what it's like counting cards or something, right? Like okay, it's still gambling, but you have a system that seems to work. I'm very intrigued by this. I think it's so interesting. I left with a lot of questions for Dan. He'd be an interesting person to talk to.
We should probably get him on the show.
Yeah. Because there were, for example, like I saw the 2,000% and I was just like, how? Like even reading the rest of this, it couldn't add up to that quite for me. I was like, how did you calculate that? I'm not, and again, like, what I'm not doing here is I'm not questioning. Mm-hmm. That's right. I just went, how is that possible here? And then it's fascinating. There are a couple things, and this is legitimately not shade. It just like raised questions for me. Where he would say, they asked about his position sizing.
Yeah.
And he said, I do 5% max, but sometimes 10% or like some other number. And I was like, what? So I just get curious, right? And I can see where during an interview, you know, like it probably just means that 5% is his general baseline, but on occasion, yeah, he, you know, goes differently, but it just raised some of these questions. But the 2,000% for me was really fascinating because one, he holds 50 to 60 stocks. Mm-hmm. And so in thinking about 2,000% over a period that isn't that long, it's about a decade, right? 2,000%, when you hold that many stocks, like you have to have some serious, like 10,000% or something like that winners in order to, with 5% holdings, like, so I'm just like, I would love to know like the breakdown because it's really fascinating. And then the other thing around 2,000% is because of the liquidity, it takes him a long time to get in and a long time to get out. He's basically like the Berkshire Hathaway of these stocks. Like right? So he has to buy over months sometimes or sell over months. And that's a hard thing.
This is quite not a system. This is not fun. And even if that value is true, one, if you get to the point where you're starting to invest like decent quantities of money, let's say tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars, like you almost can't do it in these stocks anymore. So 2,000% is one of those things on a very small asset base that I bet is believable. Let me give you another example. He didn't name this company, but 1.8 million market cap with a book value of 4 million and sitting on 1 million in cash. Like this is how Dougals you nice. Get, and the stock's currently trading at something like 10 cents. Who knows? It's not specifically listed, but you can get like 20X in this space, but all the downsides are not worth it. In my opinion, like no liquidity, you have to sit on your hands in some cases for 8 years, 15 years. Like, it's an entirely different game that's not right for us and likely not right for our listeners. But the interview was just really fun. Like,
I agree.
Really good.
I'll name one example of a company that I also like. This ride would have to be wild. There's a company called HemaCare, H-E-M-A. And he says that he started buying at 30 cents. I'll just say he bought at 30 cents. I'm sure he bought at several prices. 30 cents to $25.40 was his ride. That is out of control. Like I can't even imagine. It would be so hard for me, like with just knowing my own psychology, so hard for me to take that entire ride.
Yep. Oh, basically impossible.
I mean, it's wild. And maybe At some point, I'm sure there was more liquidity, so he probably could have sold out more easily. But that is just like it's impressive.
Yeah, I have a friend here that dabbles in this stuff, and it's like, it's a whole different world. Sometimes to get year-end financials, you have to like write by hand a letter to the management team that says like, please send me your financials. Like this is not typical public equities investing in any way, shape, or form. It's an entirely different world.
But you're going back to the 1920s. It's like when you're buying these stocks.
In a lot of cases. Yeah. And some of these companies, you know, went public long ago for a reason that's different than their current reason for being public. And they are held like 80% by the family. And they see every other investor that comes in as a little bit of a nuisance. And they're going to treat you with hostility because of it.
Yeah.
Fun stuff.
In my early investing days, like early when I was just learning what the heck any of this stuff means, I'd be like, I have my $25. What can I buy with this $25? Oh, this company is 50 cents. I can buy so much with my $25. And then 2 days later, I'd be like, where did my $25 go? Like, I don't understand. Warren Buffett told me. Anyway, so it's fun. It's pretty impressive. Yeah, he'd be an interesting guy to talk to. All right, I'm going to reach in, fishbowl, and talk about fee versus commission-based structures for financial advisors. So exciting. I tried to think of a way to make that more exciting, and I could not. So that's all you got. Sorry about that, folks. There's a Wall Street Journal piece called Your Financial Advisor Doesn't Want You to Know About These Conflicts. It's an interesting little world here. So when I first started reading this piece and I saw fee-based advisors, what I was thinking of was not folks that take a percentage of assets. I was thinking about more of like the fixed fee, hourly financial advisors. So it caught me a little bit off guard.
I'm going to interrupt there. I thought this article did a really poor job because I have to read the same paragraph three times to be like, which type of advisor are they talking about here? Are they talking about asset-based fees or fixed fees? But the examples are still pretty interesting.
Yeah. And so what it's saying is that over the past recency, I don't know what the amount of time is, but recently there's been a significant shift. I think it's the past decade what they talked about. A significant shift to people going to more asset-based fee, not fixed fee, structures versus commissions. So if you think about commissions would be, if I sell you this other financial product, I'll get a piece of it. That's like taking a commission. Versus if you invest $1 million with me, I get a percentage of that million. And people have been going more toward the, if you invest $1 million with me, I get a percentage of that million. And 2019,
these typical advisors, just to jump in, charge annual fees on a percent of assets that are often between 0.75 and 1.25 of the portfolio.
Yep.
The not talked about in this article, but if you don't know and you use someone that charges fees like that for your entire investing career, it can often take as much as a third of your asset value.
Compounding in the wrong way.
There are definitely pros to advisors, and this is not like we can talk through some of those things, but I wanted to set the stage with that. Sorry for jumping in.
Thank you. No, it's great. One last piece of context before I throw out a couple examples of things I hadn't thought about from the conflict of interest perspective. So the last piece of context is over this last decade, what this is saying, it's got this chart in here that if you go back to 2012 on the fee-based model, the percent of assets model, it was about $5 trillion that were invested with those types of advisors and more like 8 to 9 trillion with commission-based. And fee-based started taking off relative to commission-based in about, it looks about 2019 is when it finally took over. And so now we're sitting at around $15 trillion that's invested with fee-based, that percent of assets, and around $12.5 trillion with commission-based. So that's just the last piece of context. Here are the examples. I had not thought about stuff like this. So when you go back to, going back to the title, it talks about conflicts of interest. And the reason these conflicts would come about, according to this piece, which makes sense, it's very logical, is that if you're taking a percent of assets, you want people to have more and more assets invested with you. One of the things it's saying is around claiming Social Security. Mm-hmm. And so it's saying that folks tend to tap into their Social Security earlier if you are working with a fee-based financial advisor, because they want you to get that check and put it up with them.
Well, and do you know why, Diggles? Like, we have to explain the example here, right?
Go.
So in that case, you could take Social Security as early as 62 and, like, I think as late as 70. If you delay that to 70, you'll get significantly more on a per month basis than you would taking it at 62. This is all actuarial math, basically. So a lot of people who run the numbers, and this situation is different for everyone, but I'm generalizing, will say the best thing to do if you have a decent retirement account is to retire when you run a retire, pull from that retirement account to get to 70, and then pull Social Security at 70 so you have that bigger check for the rest of your life. It's guaranteed, right? But if you did that, your fee-based financial advisor, your retirement savings, let's say you retire at 62, might be like cut in a third or cut in half for that 8-year bridge to get you to the bigger Social Security check. So, Dougals, if you manage, it's just based on percent of total assets and you own the assets, I say own in terms of get fees for the retirement account, and you have nothing to do with the Social Security paycheck, what do you think you might advise a client to do? Oh, you got to tap into that Social Security, baby.
Exactly.
Gotta tap that.
It sounds like you've given that pitch before. You got to tap in that Social Security, baby.
I have not. It's just fascinating. And just people, pick up a Munger book. Like, Munger explains all of this. Life is all about incentives all the time. Yeah, and exactly. I think the financial advisors are behaving rationally in a way. The question is, if they're behaving in their client's best interests.
Yes. The next one is about mortgage, paying off your mortgage. So this is saying that there could be advantages, depending on your interest rate, payments, et cetera, to pay down that mortgage earlier, right? Double your payments, whatever it might be. But your financial advisor is saying, why are you going to pay off that mortgage? Well, you could pay me, baby, using your language. And so it has this chart in here. It's percentage of Americans age 65 and older with mortgage debt. And wow, I did not realize that it looked like this. So it goes back to, this is about 30 years, a little over 30 years, back to 1989. And that number was around 15%, just eyeballing the chart back then. Closer to 30% now. Or this goes up to 2019. So close to 30% a few years back. A doubling of percentage of Americans 65 and older with mortgage debt. So this is important. Thinking about, I only use that stat to say it's important for you to figure out how to pay that debt off, not to leave that debt to your chitlins, right? How do you pay that off, et cetera? And what are the advisors telling people to do? Well, don't pay that off.
Example. I mean, it's the same.
Yeah, it's the same. But what I don't like here is the examples are all about taking advantage of older people. Like, this is how do I get you to not pay off your mortgage debt, 65-year-old? How do I get you to not tap into your Social Security, right? This is older folks.
We're going to do the same. We're going to actually provide numbers here. So the example in the article says, I'm sitting on $1 million in my retirement account and I have a 500K mortgage, right? Many people might make the decision. It's not necessarily the right decision or the wrong decision, but they might say, you know what? I just want to be free and clear of my mortgage. So I'll take 500K from my retirement account. I'll pay it off. In that case, obviously, the amount you have in your retirement account is cut in half. And therefore, the fee that your advisor collects is also cut in half. Goes from $10,000 to $5,000. It's a really important thing to think about. Now, Dougals, I'm going to do this. We'll see if you allow me. I'm going to talk about some of the positives of fee-based financial advisory.
Oh, go for it.
Okay. Obviously, Dougals and I are investing nerds and do this independently. We've run all the numbers. We think that's right for most people. But some advantages of a fee-based financial advisor, at least this is what they'll tell you, is that you get the same quality of care as a younger person, maybe at 25, that you might at 65. And at 25, your asset base is significantly less. So they might be providing that service at a so-called loss to them. Okay? It's one potential positive. Another potential positive is it's kind of automated and mindless. Now, there's some big concerns about this, which I think we've highlighted. But it also is one of those, you know, you have an expert that you can call and you don't have to free up, oh my goodness, I don't have $5,000 this year, like free and clear to pay them. Now, I think the way that this is often done probably has more negatives than positives, but I think those are the two biggest talking points. Am I missing anything else on why this makes sense? Can make sense in certain situations. I'm struggling over here.
Yeah. In theory, you could also say that the more money you get, the more complex the thought process and work has to be. Mm-hmm. I think that there are like breakpoints where that is probably true, but all the middle ground, like for 90% plus of cases, it's not the case. But yes, if you have $150 billion, that's a lot more complex to manage than if you have a million. Like that's just true. Ask Buffett. I'm going to ask him, actually. That's the question I have. Would you say, he's just going to go, could you please sit back down, sir?
We can use that. All right. So we did our best to talk about the positives, but all in all, there's 1,000 books we'd recommend. And if you're paying high fees for someone to guide you here, we'd recommend taking a look at it because there's probably conflicts of interest and it's probably costing you a significant portion of your wealth over 30 to 40 years.
It's just a long time. Yeah. If you're going to be working with someone that long, it's going to cost a lot. It's probably what I'd say is this, though, maybe another, I don't know if this is a positive of the percentage, but if it's only for a short period of time, so you don't get all that compounding, but it's to, I don't know, maybe for you to learn or just have someone to talk to for a few years, I could see that because you don't lose quite as much. But if you're going to work with someone for 40 years, that is just a lot of money. That's so much money.
Absolutely. Now, there are potentially some behavior benefits. You know, here's, I think, how I'd say it. If you have a savvy friend or grandfather or uncle or whatever that you know knows his stuff, that's often a great place to start. But if you're from a family where you feel like there's no financial expertise and you really need someone to talk to, paying for it is probably going to make sense.
Yeah.
Now, you can and should look at paying for a yearly fixed fee because there's a lot of those advisors out. And that, what I mean there is like something like $5,000 a year to cover your financial planning needs rather than 1% of
which is going to cost you a lot more when you have less assets.
Like, exactly.
But as it grows, that's probably the way to shift. I don't know if that's what you're saying, but like if you start off maybe on the percentage basis, if it makes sense, but once you get to a certain asset amount, it's just a lot. What else you got?
That's it, Diggles.
Yeah. Well, here's something I'll raise, though, because I don't think I quite got it, but maybe you did. You sent over to me this tweet about volatility laundering.
Oh, yes. Okay. Clifford Asness at AQR is hilarious on Twitter. We talk about him a lot, right?
Yeah, I mean, and like he is. I don't know if he means to be funny.
Well, he's
cantankerous,
an emotional guy, cantankerous, and an intelligent guy, especially in the investing space, which is his expertise. So he has coined a phrase, Diggles. I thought you were up on this, but within the last say 9 months, he's coined this volatility laundering phrase. And he's done it. We've talked about this on the show because the private equity guys, some of the venture capital guys will stand up there and they'll have all these charts of like, oh, this is what private real estate did. And then they'll plot it against a publicly traded REIT of similar assets. And guess which one appears to be more volatile? It's always the publicly traded one because it's marked to market every second of every day. The private stuff, you often can't sell. So they say, because it's easier on everyone, they say like, we bought this building for $100 million. A year from now, the building's worth $100 million. And on down the line, When in actuality, if they had to sell that building tomorrow, it might be worth $20 million. They don't ever mark to, well, very rarely do they mark to market. And then they parade around to the endowments and everyone else and say, look, our assets are so much more stable. This is why you should invest with us. And he has just had it with it because he obviously trades in public markets that appear to be more volatile. So I love it. It makes me laugh every time. He's been on literally a 9-month rant now and coined the phrase volatility monitoring or volatility laundering. He is completely right. Like, give me the counterpoint here. Just because I sit on so this is like, you know, before Zillow, people would be like, oh, my home never fluctuates in value. Well, it's just because you don't actually see it fluctuate in value. Of course it fluctuates in value. You don't have to sell the thing every minute of every day or watch everyone else's transactions every minute of every day.
When something isn't volatile, question the crap out of it, is what I say. There was a good friend of mine who was a strong investor, very little volatility, is like clockwork. His name is Bernie, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Is he in jail for 150 years?
He was in jail.
He's dead now, yeah, correct?
He's no longer with us. But if so, you do Bernie not, volatility, made up friends. Volatility is just part of the game. So, but it, where it's helpful, this is not the laundering part. Where it's helpful is this, let's name Adam again. Right? He was saying that part of the reason why the private markets work best for him is because he can't see the fluctuation of the value. Psychologically, it's more helpful. But that's not claiming that the value isn't fluctuating. That's different. That's where the laundering comes into play right there. You know that it, just because you're not marking it, doesn't actually mean that the valuation isn't changed.
And so that's really well articulated. Like saying that I want to buy real estate and hold it for 10 years or live in the private markets where I know my hands are tied. Like it's impossible for me to exit for maybe 10 years is completely different and can be true. You could say, I understand the positive aspects of me not being able to sell, working in an illiquid market, because it will force me to make hopefully more rational decisions. But that's different than flat out lying and saying that volatility does not exist in those spaces.
Exactly. Do you think, let's take this to the extreme. I'm going to maximize this. You think it would work? I could raise money if I said, like, it's bad for you psychologically. If you understand the volatility that's happening, you wouldn't want to pull your money out, right? Investing about the long term. So invest with me. I guarantee you 40% annual returns, but I have to hold your money for 100 years.
You're a little too extreme there. So one, if you're guaranteeing people 40% returns, it's a straight up fraud. But two,
but you won't know for 100 years. They won't know for 100 years.
Yeah, they will. Because no asset class has ever performed 40% a year for I thought you were going to go here. Is there room in the market for a product that requires a lockup period that trades in public equities and potentially hides the volatilities from clients?
Yeah.
So many smart people think that that would improve client returns, but I think even like James O'Shaughnessy, I think other people have actively tried this and there's never been a market for it because people hate the idea of like, wait, you would know the value of my capital, but I wouldn't know, or like, you know, like people just can't get comfortable with it.
There's a market in the private markets, but not in the public. That is what's interesting. There's so much money that's put into a situation where you have a lockup period. It's just a natural lockup period, and you don't generally know, at least real time, the value. Like it exists, but not in the public markets. I agree with your point.
You know this, right?
I know.
You know why? Because I can walk into a boardroom with my private equity deck, and I can compare to like S&P 500 returns, but I get the advantage of volatility laundering and I get to use crazy leverage. I can make my, you know, I can dumb everything down. Again, I think it's effectively lying, but I can dumb everything down to say my asset class is better because we're comparing apples to oranges here. And then when my fund blows up, I just hightail it out and go work at my buddy's fund that hasn't blown up yet. It's dishonest.
All right. I think that's a wrap.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Reminder, we will be in Omaha for the Buffett get together, Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting in about a month. Come say hi if you're there. Duke goes, I believe our tickets are in the mail. So Ooh, see. Yes. I had to actually fill out like an old school envelope. I'm a little concerned about if I know how to put a stamp on an envelope and those sort of things. But yes, other than that, hit the please share the show with a friend and please review the show positively for us. That helps more people find it. Emails so we can play that jingle. skippydoogles@gmail.com.
We love that jingle. Please email us.
See ya.